Sir Explorers. Welcome to X-Squared Radio, where the past meets the future. I'm your host, Brooke Sagney. In here, the results are always positive. We explore the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. Whether you are driving across the country or listening on the web while you're working on your favorite project, you are about to learn more about who we are, why we are here, and what we may become if you thought possible. We might go a little past your imagination, but have no fear. You will be safely traveling with us. Keep your arms inside the vehicle, recline your chair, and look out the window as we launch X-Squared Radio. The foundations of religion and science were utilized to write our first two volumes of The Ark of Millions of Years. The third volume, called Unlocking the Secret, is about to hit the presses. We want you to be aware of what is coming. You and I know that your potential is absolutely unlimited. We have crafted the final work of the trilogy, so you have the tools necessary to work the law of attraction. Find out what the ancient masters knew. Learn the methods necessary to affect the universe on purpose for the good of your life. Go to the online store at X Squared Radio and get your copy on order today. If you have survived the disaster without food and clean water, then you need to visit NitroPack. They have been providing emergency preparedness supplies for more than 19 years. They have everything from 72-hour kits to a full year's supply for an entire family. We wanted you to have access to the best. That is why we searched for many months to find NitroPack. Click the NitroPack banner at X Squared Radio and get prepared. Greetings, Earth Explorers. Welcome to the program. We're coming to you live from Eastern Washington State tonight. My AccuWindow forecast says it's about 29 degrees, clear and sunny and cold. The solar wind tonight is a mild 366.5 kilometers per second. Sunspot 978 appeared over the limb of the sun early this morning and is currently six times the size of Earth. It is large and easy to see with a coronoscope, but it is stable and poses no threat for solar flares right now. There is a coronal hole facing Earth and should result in an aurora activity later on this week, possibly the 11th or 12th. NASA has postponed the launch of the Space Shuttle Atlantis to January after a sensor in an emergency engine cutoff system failed again today, once more delaying Europe's major contribution to the International Space Station. NASA has 10 shuttle flights remaining to complete the construction of the $100 billion space station. It also wants to make two resupply flights and a servicing call to the Hubble Space Telescope before the shuttle fleet is retired in 2010. A plan to build a gigantic dam across the mouth of the Red Sea that could generate huge amounts of clean renewable energy has been condemned by experts who say it would wreak untold ecological ruin. The scheme would literally part the Red Sea with a massive wall more than 150 meters high, 1 kilometer thick and 100 kilometers long, stretching between Yemen in the north and either Eritrea or Djibouti in the south. There are arguments against the idea. The project would transform the Red Sea into a briny pool, reducing the 450,000 square kilometer sea by one-third after 50 years and by two-thirds after nearly 300 years, according to the study. Furthermore, by keeping the water from the world's oceans from flowing into the Red Sea, effectively reducing the area of the world's oceans by the 450,000 square kilometers, global sea levels would rise by 12 centimeters over the project's first 50 years and by 30 centimeters after 291 years. The interesting thing is, energy production wouldn't start for 50 years after the closed-off sea dropped by 100 meters, at which time the project would yield 18 or 19 gigawatts of energy. To reach peak power production, engineers would have to wait 291 years until the sea's water level had dropped by 611 meters before reintroducing ocean water. Interesting. Last week we had open lines with many people joining us from around the country. We talked about all reincarnation and other ideas of great proportions. This week we have a great guest. He was a senior physicist and department head in charge of development, mechanical engineering, and production of the Michelson interferometer spectrometer. Those of you know the last iteration of that is now the LIGO, the Laser Interferometer Gravitational Wave Observatory. He was the host of a lecture series called A Short Course in Time, and he is currently the director of research for the Nehru Foundation. He is an author, a speaker, and the world authority on the source of the Hebrew language and writing. Please welcome with me Stanley Tenen. How are you, Stanley?
I'm fine, and that's quite a build-up. I think it's a bit strong. Many would dispute it.
Well,
but I do have a unique idea on the origin of the alphabet and what it means.
Well, that's what we're going to discuss tonight. Those of you that are interested in this, it's not just a lesson in language. It's going to be a lesson in a lot more than that. I've been reading your works and wondering about the foundations of many things while I ponder them, where to begin with the scope of your studies.
Start anywhere. It's a giant circle, and all that matters is that you jump in and come full circle.
There we go. So let's start.
We have a website at www.meru.org, and it's got tons of material. What caught your eye?
Well, I liked the part about, you know, well before the Earth cooled. And the current popular belief among the drive-by physics community is the idea of a Big Bang. So, let's just say the first words of the Bible or the Torah, in the beginning was the Word, or let there be light.
Well, that's the Christian Bible.
Where do we want to start?
The Christian Bible says in the beginning was the Word. The Hebrew Bible starts in normal translation, in the beginning God created the heaven and the earth. But there's also hundreds of alternate ways to read the same sequence of letters and words. The Hebrew Bible doesn't come with vowels, so that there are many ways you can read the same verse. And one of the things I'm proposing is that, in fact, the stories are in the words and the verses as we know them, but that the deeper meaning is in the letters, and that the way to reach it is to interpret the words and the phrases by reading them acronym style. And when you do that, you get meaning that's consistent with some of the mysterious teachings that come down historically, traditionally, where we don't know where a great teacher got that idea. If you examine the word letter by letter, you say, oh, that's what that word really means. And so I have, I didn't know that's what I was working on. Maybe we should start at the beginning.
All right. Take off. I was just saying, when I was working, you know, back through the earliest written languages, we keep getting to the root of the root of the root until we are brought to a point where there are beings but no written language. So what do we start with? Where do we begin with language?
Well, what I'm proposing starts before written language and before spoken language, with the original language that is intrinsic to all living things and, in fact, is intrinsic in the universe. The fundamental principle underlying language is pointing to something. Modern languages use letters that represent phonemes, that point to phonemes, and we read them as sounds that we recognize as words. But in the abstract, the principle of pointing is the principle of communicating and the principle of language. In physics, there's something called the quantum state vector, which is a pointing direction in some hyperdimensional space. And every entity in physics is uniquely identified because its quantum state vector points in a particular direction. We know that we point to things that we mean or we want other people to pay attention to. And the fact is that we all use the same basic gestures. And the reason we use the same basic gestures is because as humans, we have to perform the same basic functions. I developed an alphabet chart that represents gestures for the Hebrew letters over 10 years ago now. Recently, there's been published work showing that when you ask a person who's blind from birth, who's never seen gesture, to talk about pouring a cup of water, they'll do it. You're just putting your own mind. I'm sure everybody listening has this in their mind right now. You grab the cup, and you lift it, and you tip your hand over, and the water pours out. Well, a person blind who's never seen that would make the same gesture because it's the same function. If you look at the shape that I'm going to talk about that fits in the hand, when you make that gesture, you get the Hebrew letter that literally means to pour out. And, in fact, the same is true for every single letter. And, in fact, if you make gestures that spell words, you can often see what the word means, not in its idiomatic meaning, but in its root meaning. And I'll give examples if we go in that direction. So we're talking about a universal gesture language, and these gestures not only are natural to an adult who's blind from birth, who's asked to talk about pouring a glass of water, these are the same gestures that a newborn child makes to its parents before it can speak. These are the gestures that lay down the neural map that later is going to be co-opted and used for speech in all the different languages. So we're talking about the pre-Tower of Babel natural universal language of gestures. And you know how universal this is? It's amazing. The Yerkes Primate Center in Atlanta just released pictures of chimpanzees making gestures. And one of the gestures they released, I didn't examine all of them, but the one caught my eye immediately. It's exactly the same as the gesture for the Hebrew letter bet, and it means exactly the same thing. It means I beseech you. My hand is open in front. Chimpanzees naturally make the same gestures because, by and large, they do the same things we do. They don't pour glasses of water, but they handle things and move about and do, because they're our size and shape, give or take. They have the same functions. But it's not just chimpanzees. You know, there's been a lot of publicity recently about the catastrophic collapse of bee colonies. So it's brought a lot of attention to the honeybees.
Right.
Well, honeybees tell other honeybees where the flowers are by doing something called the waggle dance, where they shake themselves against the honeycomb, and they make a loop, and then they come around and do it again, and they make a loop the other way, and they come around and do it again. That geometry that tells other honeybees where to go to find the honey is exactly the same geometry that makes the Hebrew, Greek, and Arabic letters. And it could have been observed with the naked eye in the ancient world. No magic,
so
no flying saucers.
Kind of a basic and universal, even understood on an insect level.
I'm talking about a language that, I mean, most people talk about sacred alphabets or sacred language or universal language or universal alphabets, and they're thinking Esperanto, or they're thinking some universal gestures, do what I just said. I'm going even further than that. I'm talking about not only universal horizontally across the earth plane including all human beings of every age and every culture, but I'm also including other self-aware creatures like primates and elephants. I'm including creatures that don't have hands, like dolphins, who can use the same principles. If there are extraterrestrials, and I'm not sure there are or aren't, but if they are, they could use the same principle. So a completely across the plane of human self-aware existence, every creature can use this language naturally. But I'm claiming even more. I'm saying this is also vertically universal. By that I mean, as above, so below. In the below, we're talking about abstract math and physics. I'm saying the 27 letters of the Hebrew alphabet correspond to 27 base vectors that are all you need to navigate in what the physicists call Hilbert space. So this is a minimum pointing direction alphabet, not based on hand gestures, but on formal pointing directions, mathematically. And it's also, and here's the beauty part, you know how in some of the Christian traditions they have, I'm Jewish and I don't want to misrepresent or anything, so if I say this wrong, please forgive me. But there's a ritual where you ingest a wafer as the body of the hero, and you're supposed to experience some of this. Well, I'm saying that you can take what's a gesture in your hand into your mind's eye and identify it with a feeling, and you can read and write. You can ingest into your mind, not just into your body. You can read and write a mental exercise based on the Hebrew, Greek, and Arabic letters written out. And I'm saying I think there's reason to explore the possibility that what everyone has been looking for in the religious world and looking against in the non-religious world, some sort of messianic event, some sort of millennial event, some sort of rediscovery of our roots, is actually the letter text of the Hebrew Bible internalized by a person spiritually centered enough to be able to do this letter by letter. And that's the experience. That's where the exercise has been hidden. That's the whole secret. That in fact,
are we saying then that the letters of the Hebrew Bible are actually icons of feelings?
Not icons, but they represent feelings. Yeah. In fact, look, we're on the radio here, on the internet, but this is so obvious, you can even do it without seeing it. And even if I'm right, that ought to be true. So I ought to be able to explain to you and to the audience in words on the air, and you should have enough personal experience to be able to agree with me, right? Or check it for yourself.
Yes.
All right.
Yes, absolutely.
Well,
what I'm trying to say is that the Hebrew letters that actually make up the printed text by which these concepts were transferred from one person to another over hundreds, perhaps thousands.
Each letter is a feeling. Each letter is a feeling, and a mental exercise is not a sequence of images. That would be idolatry. It's a sequence of feelings. I'm saying the sequence of feelings recorded in the Hebrew letter text of Genesis is a mental exercise that leads to spiritual growth and maybe even to a much higher and greater experience if someone is really a saint. But for the ordinary person to be able to read that text and internalize the feelings represented by each letter, letter by letter, changes you, grows you up, heals, is the meditational mental exercise basis for the Western traditions. This is
now,
where
is this,
the working...
Is this is it a never-ending spiral of improvement? Because each time you read these, each time you internalize these feelings, depending on your own personal spiritual growth, you reach another level. It's like you hear something else in it on the next level.
Well, as long as we're sentient and alive, we're on a continuous growing cycle. The essence of life is given in Genesis 11. It says, fruit tree yielding fruit whose seed is in itself. You know, each one teach one. See, chicken, egg, chicken, egg, chicken, egg. Acorn, oak tree, acorn, oak tree, as long as we're alive, we are recapitulating ourselves and we are extending our minds and our bodies through ourselves, through our children, in every possible direction. That's what life is. So, yeah. There is no real end to it. Also, if we're talking about something truly transcendent and infinite, from our finite perspective, of course it's going to be eternal.
So if we found a need, because we were trying to convey feelings from one person to another, maybe we couldn't be everywhere with our hand gestures to everyone, Maybe this is why the written language was developed, so that a universal feeling could be transferred from one village to another, or from a prophet to a people.
If I'm right,
something like that.
If I'm right about this, there's two trains of development of the alphabet for two different purposes. There, and the first is the one we've all heard. I agree with the scholars. I agree with the development of cuneiform and hieroglyphics and simplification of hieroglyphics and the old Canaanite Phoenician stick figures, the old Hebrew figures, and the public demonstration of the more modern Hebrew figures, the Torah scroll figures since the Babylonian. I agree with the historical development of that the scholars lay out for us. But I'm suggesting, parallel to the development of a standard alphabet for phonetic purposes, there's this other alphabet, this gesture alphabet, and the two have become confused. The gesture alphabet has a different purpose than the phonetic alphabet. The gesture alphabet preserves mental exercises, is part of a science of consciousness, is the alphabet that the Hebrew Bible is intended to be preserved in. The standard alphabets are for civic, for commercial, for ordinary purposes, and for everyday use. And the difference is that letters in almost all alphabets are pretty much arbitrary shapes. You can make any letter mean any sound or anything you want. Just like a hieroglyphic, you make a picture of something, it could be anything you think it is. But
sure.
What I'm saying, let me tell you the story of what I think happened. Maybe that'll explain it.
Yeah,
when,
let's see how we went from energy to feelings to hand gestures to written language.
Well, it's not all the same story. I'm saying there's a particular train, and here's one way it could have happened. Abraham may not have been the first person to have made these discoveries, but in the Western traditions, he's given credit as the first person to have whose tradition has continued on. So we're going to give Abraham credit for it, knowing that this may have been perennial tradition for thousands of years prior to that, but it didn't last. Something Abraham did made it stick. And what Abraham is given credit for is discovering not the one God, but the oneness of God. Everyone knew there was a source of their consciousness in their mind. Everyone knew there was one God. They called it something different, a great mountain, the sun, whatever. But what people didn't know is a principle that we're just discovering today, and that is that what's in our conscious experience and what's in the world outside are really have the same source. So the name Lord and the name God that are set equal to unity in Deuteronomy was the discovery of Abraham. That Lord God is one, the combination, the duality, and to us it's two, but in the essence it's only one. Now what Abraham had to do is preserve this somehow, and one of the things he did is use the natural universal language, which is not Hebrew in this case, was even more universal. It's the language of simple geometry. And when you attempt to express the idea of singularity and wholeness, the one and the many, the mind and the world, consciousness and physics, Lord and God, in a single geometric form, you get something amazing. Now, people will have to look at our website to see the images and see what it really looks like. You get a model human hand, not an idol, but something that fits on the hand that represents the unification of the two names of God, represents the unification that's in Deuteronomy that some people call the Credo of Judaism. But it's also the basis of all of the Western traditions. And this model is then used, because it's the shape of information, is used to point to things and to stabilize the shape of the hand. Now, things go downhill. Jacob gives Joseph a coat of many colors. They go to Egypt. They have a rough time for a while. And we get to the time of Moses and Pharaoh. And the Israelite nation has been integrated into Egyptian society. They're all reading hieroglyphics. The hieroglyphics are all pictures of pagan idols. Everybody except the priest have forgotten the old times. And Moses leaves with this ragtag population, and they head for the Sinai. What's he going to do? The people are literate. They're doing all the slave work in Egypt, even if it's not physical slavery. They're living in an idolatrous society. They're seeing all these pagan images. They can read the hieroglyphics. How do you wean people away from hieroglyphics, which are nothing but empty idols, and give them personal responsibility and an alphabet they can use to record a tradition that rails against idols? You replace the image of the idol with a hand gesture that has the same function. So instead of drawing an outline of Alpu, the Taurian god of the Taurian age of Egypt, which is upside down our letter A, you make a hand gesture that points to your own solar plexus, your own solar center, and you take the outline of a hand that's in your hand that standardizes the shape. So you get the function without the idol. And when you put the letters in people's hands, instead of attributing them to the sun god or the moon god or some idol, when you put the letters in people's hands, you're putting responsibility in people's hands and telling them that they have their own heart to guide them, because your hands are the extension of your heart chakra, and their own mind to guide them, because you can always see your hands in your mind's eye, and their own strength to guide them, because your hands are an extension of the strength of your arms. And if you go to your Deuteronomy, you'll find that that's exactly what it says. It's bound on your hand and on your arm and on your heart and on your mind.
So
and no one's made any sense of this for the last 200 years since Napoleon killed everyone who knew about it, as best I can figure out. That's my story, and I'm sticking to it.
From your website, you said Moses turned the empty arrogance of idolatry into the personal responsibility of the people who act and speak with their own hands.
That's the point.
Learn about themselves and the forces of nature so they can be free and live by their own choices. So that's exactly the point.
So when Moses wrote
the first books, he was trying to give people images or icons that would awaken their sense of personal responsibility
but he didn't write them, and I'll tell you how they came about, but I'll have to ask a question or two. You know, there are certain things. Go ahead.
I was just trying to make the point that he was trying to awaken them to their full potential, to the fact that they are responsible for their own condition.
Yes, that's exactly so. By putting the alphabet in people's own hands, look, only a fool would worship their own servant, and everyone knows their hands do what they wish. So it's really almost impossible for a person to worship their own hands. And if the alphabet, if language comes from your hands, then you're responsible for what you say and for what you do. And after all, that is the essence of the Abrahamic tradition. That's the whole point, that you're not subject to the whims of an idol, and you don't have to pay some idolatrous priest some ablution so that the lightning bolt doesn't destroy your crop. That's idolatry. Instead, you work the seasons. You learn to be a good farmer. You learn to make your crop. You have a cycle that the lightning isn't going to hurt it. You learn the ways of the world, and you become the master and the custodian of the planet, instead of looking to others that are in charge of you. This is the alphabet of responsibility. And do you know where I found it? Did you ever hear the Bible codes? You know, these Bible codes they've been selling?
Right?
Well, there's no Bible codes. The Bible codes, but there are patterns. There are equal interval letter skip patterns. And they have a different purpose. There's a tradition that the secret of the Hebrew Bible is in the first letter, in greater detail in the first word, in greater detail in the first verse, in the first paragraph, in the first chapter, that it's a hierarchical overlay, so that you could look at one level after the next. And if you look at the first letter in the first word in the first verse, and you see, you compare them to each other, you find some really astonishing things. One of the things you find is if you write the whole verse out on a bead chain, one letter per bead, so the letters stay in order, but you can move them around a little. You can curl the bead chain up so all the letters in the first verse pair off based on only two rules. You can either pair with the same letter, or you pair with a letter that's in a mirror image position in the alphabet when you count the letters by three. And when you do that, the first verse of Genesis folds itself up into a model human hand that, when you make gestures, displays the letters used to write the first verse, to write all of Genesis, displays the Hebrew letters. The message in the first verse, the message in these letter skip patterns, in the codes in Torah, is in fact a hand that you can use to bring the text into your own mind, into your own experience, into your own life, somatically, not just reading it, but really bringing it in. That's the point.
Well, it sounds like great care was taken in writing the original text so that the astute could unfold it and match it. Just
well,
like
it wasn't exactly written.
Understanding.
It wasn't exactly written. If something is really intrinsic to this reality, if look, the scholars mm-hmm. believe that the Hebrew Bible was mostly written and edited by smart people during the Babylonian exile. If that's true, then it's just a storybook. And it was authored by people, and we can go into those kind of explanations. The rabbis and most of the Christians and Muslims believe that the Bible was given, the Hebrew Bible was given to Moses at Mount Sinai by God. Most modern people think that's too magical, and most religious people think that people writing it is too mundane. But there's a middle ground, which people don't seem to consider. There are things that science recognizes as invariant and intrinsic to this reality. Just like the rabbis and the religious leadership claims for the Hebrew Bible. Those are the invariant constants in numbers of mathematics, numbers like pi and e. Some of the truly transcendental numbers are intrinsic to this reality. And we calculate them, and we determine the number system, and we make up the images with which to write them out. But pi isn't authored by humanity. Pi is authored by, either you could use the words interchangeably, the theory of everything, or God. Pi comes intrinsic to the idea of lines and circles. There's no way to get around it, no matter how it's expressed. I'm saying that the sequence of letters of the Hebrew Bible is like pi. It's intrinsic to this reality. It's not the story. The stories are stories of the history of the ancient world that everyone, you know, the flood, everyone knows these stories. The stories are there, they're true, but they were chosen because they become a clear text, a cultural vessel for carrying a universal constant, not of a circle and a line, a universal constant of consciousness, the constant that raises us up. That's why when we internalize the sequence of letters, it helps to straighten us out. It helps us to grow, to clarify, to mature. It brings us along our conscious evolution. Each gets what they're ready for.
Well,
if a person's arrogant, they can get in trouble, but a humble person only gets what they're ready for.
Yeah, exactly, because you're teachable. So let me ask you this question, because I have some people that communicate with me by instant messaging during the program.
Yeah, we really jumped into the middle here. This is not normally where I start the story. I usually start the story when I paired off the letters at the beginning of Genesis and tried to figure out what I had. I jumped into some messianic discussion, which is going to make everybody crazy.
Well,
but we'll
see. I was going to ask a more basic question that's been passed along to me. I said, you know, why did we get the Ten Commandments?
The
and
Ten Commandments. Excellent question.
Thou shalt not.
Excellent question. Very good question. First place, the Ten Commandments in the now thou shalt not form is the way this projects down on the social fabric. But the real purpose of the Ten Commandments is to protect the integrity of the text. The commandment against not stealing, not being jealous, all these commandments turn out to be logical requirements for maintaining the integrity of data, of information. Now that's at a very abstract level, and that's for maintaining the integrity of the letter text. But since the whole idea is that this is a multidimensional system, it operates above and below and at the earth plane too, and everywhere in between, the story level, where we have do's and don'ts, is the level for guiding people who basically haven't grown up to learn that you don't, you know, rob, cheat, and steal, you know, have to be told not to rob, cheat, and steal. So that's the social engineering level. Most people these days, thank God, already know, because they have a theory of mind. They know other people bleed like they do. Have an idea. You don't torture, you know, small animals, and you treat other people with respect and kindness. So they don't need that kind of commandment. But there was a time, and there are still places in the world where those kind of commandments are needed. At every level, though.
A more base level of commandment. All right, here's some simple rules to follow that will get you from point A to point A 0.5, not even ready for point B.
Yeah, that's to get people up and running so that they can get along well enough and not beat each other up so that they can actually have a civilization. Then once you have a civilization, then you go to the deeper levels and the more refined learning.
Well, let's qualify civilization. I mean, why does most of the Christian world think that if information comes in any other from any other source than the Bible, then it must be of the devil?
That's politics,
that
I think. And also, people go through different developmental stages. There's a time when children think that their parents are withholding, are keeping secrets about sex, and they don't understand that they really can't understand until they've reached puberty. There are people who are led to believe they can understand more than they've done the work to qualify for. Most people know enough not to do their own brain surgery. They understand that you need a highly qualified person to do brain surgery. But
well,
there's a lot of...
Let's ask a more fundamental question then. Is there such a thing as sin?
Well, it depends on what you mean by that word. If you look at the Hebrew word, then I can tell you what that means. But I can't tell you what somebody else's concept is unless they'll have to tell me. The word
means to miss the mark, right?
It means to miss, it means to be bound and have one's, well, sin is basic. There are different kinds of sin. The instinct to run after what one sees without having any conscious control is the essence of sin. It's because it's our animal nature without our higher nature intervening. So when a person acts without reflection, or overreacts, or underreacts, and is not aware of the golden rule, then they're being lost in their passions. But I think that's a condition that happens, but, you know, I don't know about that. I don't really think in terms of sin. I think more in terms of getting it right. I mean, everybody gets it wrong.
Yeah, I think the same way, you know, that sin is missing the mark. Sin is destructive.
Yeah, it's just not getting where you're going. But, you know, there's something about sin that people don't understand. And that's why God is infinite. If God were only 100 feet tall, then a 10-footer would be closer to God than a 6-footer. Or a more saintly person would be closer to God than a less saintly person. But in the comparison with a truly transcendent and infinite idea of God, then even a sinner and a saint are at the same level. The only thing is the intention to do good at any instant. And there's no way to compare one to another. In the light of a transcendent, infinite God, the intention to go towards the light is the only good, and no one can compare it. And the intention to turn one's back on the light is the only dark side, and no one can compare that either. And no one can judge it. That's for God to do. Now, if God were finite, that wouldn't be true. If a person believes in a small God, then that's not true. But if a person believes in an all-inclusive, really transcendent, infinite concept of God, then the logic I just laid out is valid. That's why.
Well, isn't there also some merit to the thought that perhaps the direction of our own energy, by either consciously or unconsciously, is what judges ourselves, because we just simply can't resonate with the light. We become darkness ourselves. We judge ourselves by our own deeds.
I guess so. I'm not much into the theology of judgment. I'm more into the geometry of Genesis.
All right. Well,
I can't tell you much about that.
I was going to ask you mathematically or geometrically, what is glory?
Well, I can tell you what the Hebrew word means, but I don't know what other people mean by glory. It means to hold in itself, basically. It's the word kabod. And is that glory? No, I'm not even sure. I don't know Hebrew that well. I don't know what people mean by glory, and I'm not enough of a linguist to be sure that I'm even picking the right word.
All right.
The idea of glory is, in a modern sense, what I would compare to, this is going to sound crazy, to the wave equation. I think that there are two aspects to everything. There's a particle aspect and there's a wave aspect. And the particle aspect is discrete, and the wave aspect is like the cloud. And glory is usually described as kind of a cloud. So I'd say that the glory is basically the probabilistic space of all there is. I don't know. I don't know how to talk about
that
word. Yeah, that's not where my expertise is. I don't think in religious terms. I'm trying to get to the basis of the Western traditions, and so far what I've found is not in contradiction. In fact, it tends to support across the board the Western traditions, but in unexpected ways. And so when I apply the techniques I've used, I get results which are satisfying. If you analyze word meanings in Hebrew based on the letter meanings that we've derived by a logical process, then they make more sense than the dictionary meanings, even though they're very similar. And they clarify problems. I like to do this because it shows how easy it is to turn a negative into a positive. One of the things that causes misunderstanding in the world is the idea of a chosen people. If the Jews are the chosen people, then there are going to be a lot of stuck-up, overly self-righteous Jews, and there are going to be a lot of non-Jews who are really jealous of people who think they're chosen, you know. But in fact, that's not what the word means. The word that's being translated chosen, segula, is based on the root samek gimel lamed. And if you read it letter by letter, you get the meaning, but you learn something you didn't see coming. Samek, if you look in a dictionary, is a letter name that means to support. Gimel actually means camel, but it means action, because a camel is the carrier. And lamed is the word learn, lomed, to learn. Any person, any people that sustains the action of learning learns to be a person who makes better choices, to be a well-choosing person. It's natural for people who keep their noses in books to learn to make good choices, but that's not an exclusive. That's an inclusive. That's a light into the nation's idea. Anybody who sustains the action of learning is going to become a well-choosing person. That doesn't make them Jewish, but it gives them all the benefits of the benefit.
Okay.
And my point is that going to the letter level takes away changes a shade of meaning from something that's troublesome to something that I think is more healing. And you can do that with word after word. You get a more distinct meaning. You get a clear understanding. And this geometric understanding, this logical understanding to the structure of the letters, as opposed to just the words and the verses, gives a whole new level of meaning and precision and a whole new depth to the Western traditions.
Mm. Well, some would say that at least the more, shall we say, fundamentalists would say that the West is ever learning but never coming to a knowledge of the truth. And at some point, you stop learning and just go forward on faith. And I think that's probably the root of all the conflicts that we see in the news today.
Well, I don't know. To not continue to change and grow is to not be alive, so... People do rigidify their thinking, but that can be a phase. People who've been rigid in some of their lives can be open in other parts of their lives. We're not locked in.
Mm.
And people have life-changing experiences.
Let me ask you a question. When considering the math or even the pure philosophy of origin, we are faced with a paradox. The universe appears to be because some being was conscious that it existed. In other words, it exists because someone observed it. So
that's what quantum mechanics tells us.
Yeah, it does. I mean, the observation effect is what...
Yeah, well, that solves the riddle of when did the universe come into existence. Was it 12 billion years ago or 6,000 years ago? I learned this from a physicist who was writing in a magazine called Baal HaTorah, In the Light of Torah. And he pointed out that there is actually two birth dates to the universe, if quantum mechanics is valid. The physical universe probabilistically, in superposition, came into existence 12 billion years ago. But the history of the universe, its existence in reality, didn't occur until conscious observers matured to a point where they noticed there was a universe. That happened about 6,000 years ago, if we can believe the clinicians and the social scientists. So 6,000 years ago, somebody observed the universe sufficient to notice it was a universe, and then bingo, there was a universe. I think that's what the Bible is talking about, that the coming of self-awareness to the human species is the coming of the history of the universe. But the physical universe existed in quantum mechanical superposition just as surely as Schrodinger's cat, neither dead nor alive sure. until looked at.
Right. Independently of observation. And kind of interesting. So is the universe expanding because we are awakening?
Or we're expanding consciousness because the universe... I don't know. I think it's the same thing. There's a wonderful book, I think I mentioned it to you earlier, by Seth Lloyd called Programming the Universe, and he's saying what others are saying. The idea is that as the universe expands, consciousness expands, that there is a link between the amount of space in which things can take place and the information content of the space. And what I'm saying from the perspective of the Western traditions is that the same model is being used both in the ancient world and by the modern physicists. That we're looking at an expansion from the one to the many, from singularity to wholeness, and the universe is in along the way. We are stretched between singularity and wholeness, between the one and the many, between the word Lord and the word God, and that is in fact what the Hebrew Bible, what the letter text is laying out the path. It's the path between singularity and wholeness, the ladder, Jacob's ladder, if you will, a means by which somatically our consciousness can grow, not ego.
Well, I really like this idea that consciousness or awareness of sentient beings has an effect not just on the existence of the universe, but the shape and the movement of the universe. And I want to cover that more in our next hour. My guest is Stanley Tenen, and his website is meru.org, meru.org. Check it out. Maybe while we're at commercial, we'll be back in about 4 minutes, and we'll learn more of the origin of the universe. And we're going to go way deeper than that. This is a 3-hour program, so hang around with more. Stanley Tenen. We'll be right back. Foundations of Religion and Science were utilized to write our first two volumes of The Ark of Millions of Years. The third volume, called Unlocking the Secret, is about to hit the presses. We want you to be aware of what is coming. You and I know that your potential is absolutely unlimited. We have crafted the final work of the trilogy, so you have the tools necessary to work the law of attraction. Find out what the ancient masters knew. Learn the methods necessary to affect you on purpose for the good of your life. Go to the online store at X Squared Radio and get your copy on order today. If you have survived a disaster without food and clean water, then you need to visit NitroPack. They have been providing emergency preparedness supplies for more than 19 years. They have everything from 72-hour kits to a full year's supply for an entire family. We wanted you to have access to the best. That is why we searched for many months to find NitroPack. Click the NitroPack banner at X Squared Radio and get prepared. Have you ever thought about owning a telescope? I mean a really good telescope. Well, at the Discovery Store, you can find the world's best telescopes at great discounts and free shipping. They have come a long way, you know. Most of the comets discovered in the last 50 years were found by amateurs. There is no better way to view the sun than with a coronoscope. Trust me, you will be captivated if you ever get to watch the sun through one of these units. Who knows? You might just save the planet. So plan a trip to the Discovery Store at X Squared Radio. This is Brooks Agnew with X Squared Radio with a message for our friends in the radio broadcast world. If you have noticed that your listeners aren't around anymore, it's because they are right here with us. If you would like them back in your radio fold, then all you have to do is add X Squared Radio to your program content. The statistics don't lie. We are now the fastest growing talk radio program in North America. Don't be late, because we are about to launch another hour of X Squared Radio. Welcome back to X Squared Radio. We're coming to you live from Eastern Washington State, where it's cold and crisp and all the Christmas lights are out in all their beauty. We welcome you, your consciousness, your awakeness to us here at this radio program at this time. Hey, the first radio telescope dedicated to the search for extraterrestrial intelligence, that's SETI, has formally started operations. The first phase of the Allen Telescope Array, which is being built near Hat Creek, California, has begun functioning with 42 radio antennas. When complete, the ATA will have 350 dishes, each about 6 meters wide. Until now, the SETI project has relied on time borrowed from instruments like the Arecibo Radio Telescope in Puerto Rico and has little control over the extent and nature of the observations. The Allen Telescope Array, however, named for Microsoft co-founder Paul Allen, who donated seed money for the project, will allow SETI astronomers to survey the skies for signs of alien intelligence 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. This will be the first time that we can actually have a telescope with the characteristics we can determine, says Jill Tarter, director of the Center for SETI Research in Mountain View, California. The ATA will look for radio signals in frequencies ranging from about 1 to 10 gigahertz. Crucially, SETI astronomers will be able to commandeer the telescope for their own exclusive use when necessary. Quite amazing. We're going to look for great things from that telescope. We also want to open up the phone lines this hour. You can call us anywhere in the U.S. toll-free at 888-228-4494. Anywhere in Canada, toll-free 877-489-6350. And anywhere else on planet, off planet, if you can reach a cell phone tower, you can reach us at 530-776-5154 or 530-776-5185 or 530-776-9916. And if you're using Skype, you can reach us at BBS Radio. And if you're using Powpok, you can reach us at BBSRadio_com. And we always take flash messages on AOL Instant Messenger. You need to type in Vision Officer and search for me, and you'll find me. We also want to let everyone know that we are broadcasting live on the BBS Radio Network and the SDLI Radio Network. My guest tonight is Stanley Tenen. He is an author, a lecturer. He's the former physics director of... I'm trying to find my notes here. I've been going so fast.
I'm director of research for Meru Foundation.
Yeah, director of research for the Meru Foundation.
That's what I am. And we set Meru up in 1983.
And check that out. Yeah, 1983 is a long time. And how long has the website been up?
The website's been up since the early 90s. We were, my wife worked at the MIT computer labs in the early 70s, and so she was up on the internet, and we had email addresses, and going way back to the beginning, our email address is actually at the old well site in Sausalito. I think they just upgraded it or something. So we've been around for a long time. When I was at Brooklyn Poly, they were running computers using vacuum tubes and punch cards.
And, wow, and that's amazing.
64K would have been a whole building.
Yeah. I remember being at the University of California at Irvine, and the Canon rep came in and upgraded our computers to 8K. And he said, nobody will ever need more than 8K of RAM.
Uh-huh.
I thought that was pretty...
Yeah, for their password.
Yeah, for their password, that's about right.
That's the way it's going.
Well,
you'll need that for the spam filter.
Exactly. Yeah, that's one keystroke now in Microsoft. And you say in one of your papers that the most intelligent of intelligent designers is the one who uses the least effort. That makes sense.
Yeah, that would be it.
The principle of least action is fundamental in nature.
Absolutely.
Logically, the infinitely intelligent designer needs to use no more than infinitesimal effort and needs to take no more than an instant. So my question is there an ultimate design?
Not a designer. A source, because that's from our perspective. If the Hebrew Bible understood as it's originally intended to be understood is true, then the idea of God is beyond our knowledge. And the only qualities we can understand are, you know, what we're told. So the idea of a designer is, it's the wrong level. That's what someone at our level of consciousness might do. What
right.
The source of consciousness, the source of the universe does is to provide a continuous supply of what it takes to build anything and everything from thought into reality. It's a negentropic mm-hmm. gradient. Roger Penrose, the famous physicist, wrote a series of books recently, starting with The Emperor's New Mind. I think the most recent one is The Road to Reality. And he gives the same model in both books. And no one disputes this. This is pretty obvious. Most of the things that I'm proposing have been said by other people and are pretty obvious. It's just the way you put them together that makes them interesting. What Roger Penrose said is that all life is dependent on the difference between the sun and the sky. Humans, animals, animal creatures eat the plants, and the plants get the organizing information they need to be alive, to build their living system, because they absorb photons via chlorophyll that come from the sun, and ultimately the planet radiates photons back to the sky. But there's a difference. The sun provides collimated photons at white light frequencies, which relatively have high amounts of organizing information. And the light, the infrared, that the planet radiates back to the dark sky is radiated over a very wide angle and in the infrared and has relatively low information. The difference between the sun and the sky is the information that the plants eat, metaphorically eat. It's no different than the idea of a garden hose. No different than the idea of a garden hose. At the nozzle, there's high pressure. But at the end of the spray, which is spread out, there's low pressure. And in between, the plants get some nourishment. That's a cruder, basic idea. Well, the idea in the Hebrew Bible, the idea of how this comes about, there's a statement, I never remember if it's the Proverbs or Psalms, but there's a statement that says that the Lord God is a sun and a shield. Now, we're talking about the Abrahamic traditions, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, where the idea that God is a sun is idolatry. So that's a metaphor. How can the Lord God be a sun and a shield? Well, wait a minute. That's what Roger Penrose says is the source of life in the real modern physics world. The sun is a singularity, and the sky is like a surrounding shield. Well, that's what the two different names in the Hebrew Bible mean. The word Lord doesn't mean son, S-O-N or S-U-N. It means a transcendental source, a hyper-sun, something that's, if the sun is relatively bright and relatively pretty far away, then this idea of Lord is infinitely bright and infinitely distant and infinitely singular. And likewise, the sky is pretty dark and pretty far away. The idea of God is infinitely absorbing and all-inclusively far away. So that if you take the idea of a sun and a shield mechanically in the normal physical world, and you knock it up a notch to the spiritual level, to the level of principles and abstractions, then you can say that the actual source of all of the organizing information, I'm getting to answer your question, all of the knowledge, all of the intelligence, all of the choices is fed by this negentropic stream from the singularity that we call by the name Lord, and the all-inclusiveness that we call by the name God. And that, in fact, I only learned this recently. This should be a lesson for everyone. I spent pretty much 30 years doing this work, reading modern English translations, and I came upon an idea in the work of Carlos Suarez, who is a Christianized Kabbalist and has some really fine work out there. He's passed away recently. And I didn't realize until recently where Carlos Suarez got the idea. I found a 16th century rabbinic text that nobody has even translated. It's about an inch thick. It's in Aramaic. It's practically unreadable. I'm not sure it's in Aramaic or Hebrew even. And in this text, it describes what I'm talking about. It's got a name. It's called Shefa Tal. The word Tal means dew. Dewdrop. It's a metaphor for a photon of consciousness. And there's a continuous flow, an effulgence, a flow of this dew. Just like water flows, sprays out of the nozzle of a hose, just like photons spray out of the sun in all directions to be absorbed by the sky, this is the transcendental sun and the transcendental sky. And we are what grows between those two extremes. And by definition, if you think logically, by definition, everything in all of the universe must be between the most infinitesimal infinity and the most all-inclusively infinite infinity. Between singularity and wholeness, there's a place for everything.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that, I'm saying, is the geometric basis of the Western traditions. And when you bring it down to the earthly level, you get the Ten Commandments that help people to live decent lives and get along with each other. But at the abstract level, you get these life-changing, consciousness-changing insights into creation and consciousness and language and the fundamentals of reality.
Well, the flow of these photons, and by the way, they aren't necessarily visible.
Not physics. They're not physical photons. These are not physical photons.
Yeah.
Penrose's photons are physical.
A photon is not physical, though. It doesn't have no mass.
No, Penrose's photons are, I mean, but the photons of modern mathematical physics was what Penrose is talking about. The photons of consciousness that the rabbis are talking about are at another level. There are analogies between a garden hose and photons and these hyperphotons. They are analogous, but they're not the same. They're at different levels. God is not the physical sun, but God has the quality of an infinite example of a kind of sun.
Exactly.
You know,
but these photons are pouring out upon all conscious beings. So these, and whether they're
yes,
or
God reigns on the good and bad equally. Isn't it true?
Right.
Doesn't the Bible say God reigns on the good and the evil equally? Yeah.
Right.
That's what this means.
People,
is it?
Pay no attention to it because it doesn't resonate with them. But the light going into plants, this kind of energy going.
There's
into
an upwelling of life. Now, this isn't an animistic or a pantheistic theory, but there's an upwelling of space-time from within the center of everything at all times. That's what Seth Lloyd is saying in terms of information theory and modern physics in the book I mentioned earlier, but that's what the rabbis were saying 200 years ago until Napoleon killed all the ones that knew.
But doesn't this information go into the very minerals that we eat, we consume, and thus it entangles all of us?
Now you're talking about
energy.
Now you're talking about the kosher laws, which nobody seems to understand. I don't know as I expected to explain kosher laws on the radio here, but I think maybe the point is worth making. What, according to the model I'm describing, and there are other ways of understanding, so I'm not claiming absolute truth here, I'm only claiming I have a coherent story, and this is a meaningful story. In the version I understand, in the Garden of Eden, humanity is given personal responsibility and an ego that can learn to make mistakes and learn to make good choices. And thus we're cast out of the garden so we can learn to make choices and live by the consequences, an eye for an eye, the consequences of our own actions. By the way, an eye for an eye is not plucking out an eye. It's a spectrum of causes leads to a spectrum of consequences. An eye is the spectrum the eye sees, not the physical eye.
Okay.
And when we're cast out of Eden, we come into the world and we gain our egos, which is the way we're living now, and we interact with each other and we do good and bad. We learn to tell the truth and to treat other people nice, and we have good friends, or we learn to do lousy things and we have lousy friends and have a lousy life. But we all make our own choices and we learn to live by them. And then sometimes we get, in our life, we get old and we start to let go, or we start to grow up and we realize we're not in control of everything anyway, no matter how powerful we think we are. And we start to let go of our ego and become a bit more saintly, a bit more loving and kind and less egocentric and driven. And that, in its extreme, is the messianic experience. When one drops one's ego entirely, then one can be shalem, in balance, in harmony, which is the story of Rabbi Akiva and how he goes to paradise and meets the Messiah and then comes back because he's balanced and in peace. So we get our ego in Eden, and we give it up at the end of our life, either symbolically or historically, and it doesn't matter how you make the overlay. And the purpose of that is to learn to make good use of these photons of choice that are constantly raining down and coming up from within us that our life is riding on. And that's the difference between, that's why in my idea, now this is not Rabbi speaking, this is Stan Tannen with his own theory, but I think part of the understanding of the difference between, say, kosher meat and non-kosher meat is that kosher meat comes from animals who were grazers, who didn't use up their choices, and who died without pain. That's part of the way they have to be slaughtered. Is if there's pain, then it's not kosher. So that they die without having used up their shefatal, their quantity, their real spiritual nutrition. Whereas predatory animals, like a wolf, for example, which would not be kosher, makes choices in the hunt and doesn't retain any spiritual nutrition. They're still going to provide, if you're starving, you're required to eat a non-kosher animal. You're not allowed to, you know, die because something's not kosher. But you don't get any spiritual nutrition from an animal if you eat the animal, if you're a carnivore. If you eat an animal that has used up its choices, whereas you do get spiritual nutrition from an animal that hasn't. That's the theory. It may be symbolic. It may be real. I'm not trying to distinguish it, you know, at this point. But I'm saying the theory is that what's most precious in this life is that we are given free will when we come into the world, and we give it back up when we leave the world. And the part of us that's...
Well, I was going to ask the question, this source of information that comes to and is consumed by these animals, becomes part of these animals, and then ostensibly becomes part of the being who consumes it, namely us. What is the source of information being God, but what is the natural geometry of that information?
It's the contrast between singularity and wholeness, between the center point of a circle and the surrounding circumference. That's the ultimate shape of information, the ultimate contrast. There's a famous mathematician who can demonstrate that all of formal logic, a guy's named Spencer Brown, all of formal logic is based on the distinction between inside and outside, between a center and a surround. That bit,
right,
that contrast, is the archetype of all contrast, and that's why it's in everything that carries information. Every bit and every byte is a unit of contrast. And the archetypal unit of the greatest contrast conceivable is the contrast between singularity and wholeness, between Lord and God.
Some would say that's the contrast between source being unaware and source saying, I am, inside and outside.
I'm not sure of that.
Well, at some point, Source became self-aware and said, I am, and that was the creative force from which the universe jumped, some scholars say.
Oh, okay. I guess people have said that. I don't think it is logically consistent to try to figure out what happened before creation. And there are Talmudic teachings that make it very clear that to do that, it's not so much you can't do it. It's that if you do it too much, you go crazy. If you read the life story of Greg Cantor, the guy that did all this work on infinities, he literally went crazy because he ran into a logical inconsistency involving in the continuum and various levels of infinity. The Talmudic sages warn against trying to figure out what happens before one's postulate of an initial condition. That's a violation of the coherence of logic. So what you end up with is something arbitrary or paradoxical or meaningless. You may think you have something, but it's like dividing by zero. You can get anything out of it, and anything is nothing. It doesn't tell you anything. It's like, you know, I love the ending of the Raiders of the Lost Ark when they've got the Ark, but it's in the warehouse, and even though they've got it, it's just as lost as it ever was.
Yeah, exactly.
Context
right.
is everything.
As lost as it ever was.
Context
well,
is everything.
Yes, it's forbidden, and yes, maybe we do go a little crazy when we think about it, but those people that work iterations to their very end, and we physicists are the worst at it, we hate coming up with answers infinitesimally small or infinity, so we just keep working the equations or different.
Well, I'll tell you, having violated the rule and done that, I'll tell you what I found. If you run the if you run the geometric model I'm proposing, which isn't the only thing you could do, so I'm not saying this is the truth with a capital T. This is simply an experiment I ran. If you run the geometric model I'm proposing, and you start out with this principle of singularity and wholeness, and you go up through the dimensions, you end up with the model hand that makes the Hebrew, Greek, and Arabic letters in the higher dimensions in 3D. But if you project back down logically into a singularity below one dimension, you find out that intrinsic to a singularity are -7 internal distinctions. Now, that may not mean anything. It sounds, I can't expect anybody to understand what that means. But one possible meaning to a 7-distinction space is that it's toroidal, it's self-referential. So when you get within a point, it's as if you're going within yourself. You're infolding instead of unfolding. But you get the same topology. You get the same relationships, even if the geometry changes. You get the same inside-outside universal relationship. As the old Eastern tradition said, it's turtles all the way down. It's tortoises. It's tori all the way down.
right. Shinto, the universe or the world exists on the back of a tortoise.
But this is model making. It's not universal truth. The map and the territory are not the same thing. I'm talking about ancient maps that became the basis of our religious traditions. But the truth is what we feel. The maps are only to bring us to the brink of the feeling.
Well, there are icons or things that traditionally have excited the faculties and the imagination and even inspired people to know the truth. J.J. Hertog says even David's shield was more than a metallic object. Connected with the Star of David, it was the sign of deliverance and a powerful force field that creates its own energy, light, and sound principles. And he goes on to describe a lot of the functions of David's shield.
I know Jim Hertog, and he's a good friend. But his material is basically his personal interpretation. I'm trying to stick to the methods of science, not because they're necessarily any better at getting at the truth, but because if you use objective methods, you can communicate directly with other people who use objective methods. Jim's way of knowing and gaining that level wasn't objective. And so whatever truth value it has, it's not in the same arena with the kind of geometry I'm talking about. For example, the idea of the Urim and Thummim, some people would talk about that as the breastplate too, and someone connect it with the Mogen David, with the Star of David and all. That turns out to have a meaning geometrically that's pretty clear. It's one of the things that also comes from the first letter and the first word of Genesis.
Mm-hmm.
But my interpretation, for whatever its value may be, is an objective way of getting information. And others could follow what I did and get the same result. Jim is giving an interpretation that is true to his feelings and will inspire others, but you can't confirm it objectively. At least I don't think so. I hope I'm not insulting him by saying that.
No. I understand.
Jim, by the way, is one of the few people who stood up and actually provided, went on the record when we were attacked by lunatics who were still doing it. And Jim Hertak, I must say, was one of the few people with a public reputation. Also, besides Jim Hertak, Hoagland, also stood up and regardless of whether I agree or disagree with people, it's the integrity that makes the difference. So I disagree with Jim on some of these details, but I stand up and I support Richard Hoagland and Jim Hertak, whether or not I agree or disagree with what they're saying in any one issue, because their method is honest.
Right, that's what's important, is the scientific method and how they derive their ideas, and even their personal observations are legitimate.
Well, in this case, we're talking about simply basic integrity. I don't think that Jim Hertak is using the scientific method when he's describing the breastplate or whatever that way. But there is an integrity in what he's doing. And ultimately, even when we make mistakes, we all make mistakes. What counts is the integrity that went into what we did, not whether we got it right or wrong. And if we got it wrong, we've got to apologize and fix it. But nevertheless, it's the integrity of our action. The people who have misused this kind of knowledge have been people who have basically ripped it off and misrepresented it. And what happens is it doesn't do any good, and it leads to just confusion and nonsense. So I really appreciate people who don't agree with technically in some cases. I agree with Hoagland on some things technically, but I don't agree with everything. But I think it's very important that people understand when someone stands up and acts with integrity, because that ultimately is the model I'm proposing. The model, I have a graphic that's up on the website someplace, of integrity. And the model of integrity is a vertical upright line reaching from a circumference to a center. It's standing up. It's being directly aligned along the information axis from singularity to wholeness. That's integrity. That's oneness. That's coherence. That's Einstein's standard for truth. It's not the data. It's the internal coherence of the model that tells you that you can trust it.
Let's move on from there. You have something you call the delta function, and I'm pretty familiar with that. In physics, the smallest stable three-dimensional shape is the tetrahedron. In print, this looks like a triangle or a delta. So help us understand how this becomes the singularity or source pulse for everything that is.
Well, they're not the same thing. A tetrahedron is the simplest symmetrical polyhedron in 3D. A triangle is the simplest symmetrical form in 2D. But neither one of them is the delta function. The delta function is named that because it starts with a triangle, which is a delta shape. That's given a unit area. And then the delta function is acted on in a geometric way. The triangle is squeezed so that its base gets narrower, but it's made taller and taller because its area is kept the same. And when the base goes to zero, if the area were to still be a unit area, that means the amplitude of the triangle would have to go to infinity. So you get a very sharp vertical pulse, like a lightning bolt. And that single pulse, if you were to look at its spectrum, if you were to put it through a wave analyzer, would have components across the spectrum from of all frequencies over all time, but of infinitesimal amplitude. So you get two things from the Delta Triangle. And Dirac was the guy who came up with this. This was his wave particle model. The delta function, the vertical line itself, is the particle nature. It's a single thing. It's instantaneous. It's located exactly. It's very mechanical, very linear, and very singular, like the Lord name in the Bible. And the spectrum of all the frequencies that make up the delta function is the opposite. Instead of being infinite in amplitude, it's infinitesimal in amplitude. But instead of being instantaneous in time, the spectrum is eternal over all time. So it's the exact complement to the pulse. And the four-letter name, Lord, and the five-letter name, God, are complementary, sort of yin-yang, but in a different kind of way. Together, they represent this principle of unity. That's what the proclamation in Deuteronomy says. The Lord, God, is one. The two names together are one. If you project that model, by the way, geometrically, you get the shape of the model hand that makes the letters, the actual geometry of the spiral that comes from the equation r theta equals 1 is the model that gives you all the letters, which is a confirmation that this makes sense, because it actually works.
Well, all right, let's talk a little bit about the triangle, because let's just make an assumption that it's isosceles, and the peak, the point of this triangle is somewhere located, because we're looking at a specific window of spectrum or a mean of the spectrum, someplace that we select, wherever we happen to be looking at the time, is where all of these frequencies are collected, even though we're
focusing on one
frequency. The point that I'm trying to get to is that there is all information inside the area of this triangle, but that it is the mathematical sum of all of the frequencies inside it, is it not?
Yeah, right. That's a different principle. The idea is that the boundaries of a space determine the frequencies that can occur within the space, the structures that can resonate in the space. It's like a flute, the size and shape of a flute.
Not the other way around. I mean, isn't it the frequencies that are inside it and the resonance of it that determine the shape of the boundary?
That's possible, but doesn't occur in nature as often, but it depends on what you're talking about. The two are inverses. If you drop a pebble into a pond, it will make ripples that reach out. If you were to turn time around and send the ripples back in, it would eject the pebble back out of the pond. It's the same model. The vertical line is the pebble, and the pond is the spectrum, is the frequency spectrum. So
well, I guess
the pebble is the one.
What I'm trying to get to is, if the universe is the sum total of all the consciousness of all the sentient beings in it,
right?
Some of those beings being asleep or unconscious, and some of those beings being awake and conscious and consciously observing or intending in the universe, then the boundary of the universe is going to change based on the level of awareness or awakeness of the sentient beings in it.
Well, the word boundary is tricky because you can have a boundless space. I'm not sure. The logical boundary of everything can be simply stated as all there is. You're by definition saying this word, I'm saying all there is, this phrase means everything. And then in contrast to that, you can take something that is the least of the space, infinitesimal, and you can say that between the infinitesimal and the everything, everything else has to be someplace in between there. You know, if it's a little bigger than infinitesimal, then it's between infinitesimal and infinite. So those are the logical boundaries of the universe. The physical boundaries of the universe, I don't know what to tell you. This is an information theory, not a physics theory.
Well, one of the things that we know, or that we surmise from our observation from this place in the universe, is that the universe is still expanding. So infinity is a process, not, you know, a finite number, at least as far as the universe is concerned, and maybe it's expanding because we are observing it further and further out into space.
It could be a linkage. I don't know if we could be the cause, but we could be the result, and then we could be the cause of the result, and it could be a chicken and egg thing. the observer creates the universe to observe, which creates the, you know, it can be chicken and egg. That's possible.
Yeah, well, I mean, by definition, space, as opposed to void, is an area that contains energy or particles. And isn't the observation of a sentient being in the void energy? So therefore, space is being created by observation.
I'm not sure if that's how it fits together. It's tricky going between information and physics. Anything's possible and conceptual in information space, but not everything seems to happen physically. So I don't know where that line is.
Well, it's hard to get out there to the edge of the universe to test it, but at least mathematically it's pretty solid. So my point is, what I'm trying to ask here and what I want to work my way up to is, are we individually, are we created beings, or are we all parts of the one being?
Probably both. I think that incarnations are simultaneous and sequential, because from the level of the transcendent, simultaneous and sequential are the same thing. They only appear to be different at our level. I think that the past is just as changeable as the future. I think physics demonstrates that. You can retroactively make an observation, and it will change a real outcome. And that's been demonstrated in the lab.
Yeah, even in the past. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So you can change the past. You don't have to time travel to change the past. You can change the past in the way your consciousness works, because only you know your own past.
Mm-hmm.
Most people can't
tell.
So
you go back and reobserve something that happened to you or some effect that you think you had on someone else, and you change because of that observation.
That's true. But you also can't tell from very early ages what you dreamt and what you really experienced. Can you be sure when you were 2 years old of an experience, whether it was a dream or really happened? And how you remember that makes a difference in what was real.
No doubt about it. That is the observation. How you remember it is the observation. So if you change the way you remember it, then you've changed.
Well, the point of the alphabet of gestures that I'm talking about is to empower a science of consciousness that will be able to answer the questions you're asking me that I can't necessarily answer directly immediately. That basically this alphabet is not just for reading, writing, and arithmetic. This is an alphabet of articulations of the hand and of the mind and of the heart together. And as such, it informs us as to how the choices we make right now affect the world we're going to be experiencing. So rather than step outside of history and be some sort of godlike observer looking down on creation, we step back into the middle of history and put responsibility in our own hands.
Very
so that's what I'm. That's what I can talk to. I can't tell you the end result of. I can't write Shakespeare. I can only teach you the alphabet that Shakespeare used to write Shakespeare.
Well, does the human hand gesture also link to a feeling that is related to the energy of the communication?
I don't know about energy of communication, but gestures come with feelings. You make the sleepwalking gesture. You mean projection. And you see the outline of the Hebrew letter, Zion, which means to project. If you outline we could go through spelling the names of letters. But if you put your hands to your mouth in the megaphone in the shouting gesture, you see the outline of the letter Pei, which means mouth or speak. It's that simple. That's what's meant by natural universal gesture language. There's nothing magical about it.
When I was learning kanji, which is the style of writing that you see in Japanese and Chinese, actually the Japanese inherited kanji from the Chinese and made some modifications, and they write in four different languages simultaneously in the same sentence, not the least of which is English, they too make hand motions when making these paint strokes, and that's why,
there is a natural connection there. Yeah. Wow. Hebrew letters, when you make them now, you write Hebrew right to left, but you draw the letters left to right, which is orthographically very inconvenient because it's very hard not to smear your own line when you do that. So the letters are not being written this way for orthographic convenience. They're being preserved this way because there's a technical significance to it. Otherwise, you wouldn't do something inconvenient. You'd change it.
Right. And the way, the sequence of paint strokes or pen strokes or stylus strokes is important in writing the language.
Yes. And certainly in feeling the meaning as you write it. In fact, when you're writing a Torah, you have to meditate on each letter. You have to be in a centered feeling. And basically, you have to be as sacred as the letter you're writing. And if you're not in that space, if you're imbalanced, if you're angry, or something else is wrong, then you can't write a Torah scroll. You can't form the letters. The letters, even if they were properly shaped, wouldn't have the proper purity. They wouldn't carry the right feeling.
I think this has correlation too with Tibetan Buddhism when they use sand to draw their mandalas. They are meditating as they dribble the sand into the shape.
The highest mandala, the Sri Yantra, the creation mandala in the Vedic system, which is related to the tones of the Vedic alphabet, is also related to the geometry in the first verse of Genesis.
Very good. Hey, we have a caller. Caller, your first name and where you're calling from, please.
It's Haya from Victoria.
Hi.
Hello, Haya. How are you?
Fine, thank you. I have a question for Stanley Tennant.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes, I was just thinking about it. Is that where the Hamsa comes from?
The Hamsa hand symbol is a modern magical symbol. It has simple significance, not what people think. It's a way of laying out the 12 permutations of the four-letter name on the 12 sections of the four fingers. But it's mostly a magical amulet, and it's not really a serious form. But it came about as an echo of something serious.
Oh, and how about the Torah? I mean,
there's
the Kabbalah, there's the Talmud, and there's the Torah. Would the Torah is the five books. Yeah. Okay. Go ahead. I'm listening.
Torah is the five books of Moses in written form.
Yes.
Talmud is the oral Torah that was only written down about 2,000 years ago during persecutions. It was carried orally until fairly modern times. Kabbalah is a hodgepodge of material. The word basically means reception, and it was a tradition handed down also. But what is taught as Kabbalah today is really just mostly entertainment and nonsense. It's not the genuine article.
So the Kabbalah actually would be the source, would be the Tarot?
The Tarot is completely illegitimate. Kabbalah has nothing to do with Tarot. I know most modern people think they're the same thing. That's an abomination. The Tarot is basically just sickness. And the Tarot card, people put the Hebrew alphabet on the Tarot cards to give them more legitimacy. That's just nonsense. It has nothing to do with religious traditions. It has nothing to do with science. It's the only place where Tarot can be beneficial is if you have a talented person who uses the Tarot cards as their personal tool, and it's the person who's using them that's doing the good work. The cards are mostly just misleading.
It's like an oracle, like when you're working with yourself. It's yourself telling yourself something.
Yourself telling
yourself.
Well, I don't know what you mean.
When we're talking about the
hand symbols, as far as, going down to the very basics.
Well, I'm not talking about hand symbols. I'm talking about one particular model hand that when worn generates the outline of all the Hebrew, Greek, and Arabic letters. Hand symbols are idolatrous images. That's not what I'm talking about.
Okay. That's fine. Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Okay, thank you very much.
Yeah, you're welcome.
So the hand itself, in held in certain positions, lines up with energy that overlays the hand that has to do with this letter?
No.
The lettering of the alphabet?
No. If you make a geometric model that extends from singularity to wholeness, it turns out to fit in your hand, and it represents God's will. It represents the contrast between the four-letter name and the five-letter name. It's completely asymmetrical. So when you make gestures, you see the outline, because it's asymmetrical, it looks different in 2D, in shadow, as you rotate your hand, as you make different gestures. Each different gesture displays the outline of a different letter, and the meaning of the gesture is the name of the letter. So if you make a gesture, the sleepwalking gesture for a projection, you literally see the outline of the Hebrew letter Zion, which means spear or arrow or projectile. If you put your hands to your mouth to make the megaphone speaking mouth gesture, you see the Hebrew letter Pei. The word Pei, the name of the letter, means mouth. And the same is true for all the other letters. And if you spell words using these gestures, someone can see what you mean. If I was Christopher Columbus and you were a Native American and I wanted you to get me something round, I would outline the shape of a basketball or a melon or a globe with my hands. Everybody knows the gesture. Well, if I was wearing this model hand in my hand when I was making the gesture, I would see the outline of the Hebrew letters that spell the word round by making the gesture that everyone knows means round. That's a natural universal gesture language. It's not a spoken language. And it's not the gestures of a naked hand, of a photorealistic hand. The model hand being used is a geometric representation of the unification of God's name in Deuteronomy. And I found it in Genesis. I didn't know about Deuteronomy when I found it. I didn't even know what it was when I found it. I found this shape in Genesis, and it later turned out to be this letter-generating hand model. By the way, it comes from something else that everyone's known all over the world forever. If you go to the Philippines, they have something called the wine dance. If you go to the Middle East, they have the candle dance or the flame dance. And there are other places that have something called the plate dance. And what the mounts do is you put a wine glass or a candle in the palm of your hand, and you rotate it around. And you can only keep rotating it if you alternate going above and below your shoulder. And if you cut that orbit in half, you get two of these hand models that make the Hebrew, Greek, and Arabic letters. They come from the flame dance. The flame letters come from the flame dance, which was known through in perennial tradition even before Abraham. But we don't, it didn't come down to us intact until Abraham. Does that help? Hello? Levana? Are we still on the air? No one's talking to me. Hello? Well, it's dropped out. The phone dropped out. It made a beep.
Okay, are you there, Dr. Brooks? Brooks?
smile. It's not the way you move in style. It couldn't be that you are free. It's not the way you look at me. Only the Lord above, he knows if this dies or if this grows. Could you be the one for me? Maybe you came in my life for a reason, or maybe you came just for a season.
Oh, you gotta love technology. I don't know what happened, but all of a sudden I dropped off the universe and everybody could hear you, but they couldn't hear me. Are you still there,
Well,
Stan?
I couldn't hear anything. I couldn't hear you or anything at all. The phone went dead from my perspective. I couldn't even hear my own microphone.
Well, everybody was listening to you because we could hear you coming out over the air, but that's the wonder of internet radio. Sometimes the airwaves just don't cooperate with us. But I was listening to everything you said, I just couldn't respond. So let's pick up where we left off. We were talking about these basic, they're not necessarily hand gestures, they're hand shapes, right, that line up.
No,
with,
it's always, the hand is always held in the same shape. The hand is
always
in the same
shape.
You think of it this,
okay.
Think of it this way. Picture an apple. Pull out the stem and stuff your thumb down into the core. And pull out a chunk of the apple against your hand and scoop out all the meat so nothing's left but the skin of the apple. And it spirals around your thumb and then it sits and fills out the fan of your fingers. So you have this entirely asymmetrical flowering lily shape. And it's based on the Egyptian spiral, the most asymmetrical spiral. And it's the embryonic spiral, and it spans between singularity and wholeness. And it represents the process by which everything comes into reality in the universe. Singularity to wholeness. From conception to gestation to birth. From clear thinking to hard work to letting go. At every manifestation comes about in the same three stages. It's given in I think in Exodus as gold and silver and brass. And it represents the three stages of growth. The conceptual stage, the gestational stage where you do the work, and then the birth where the new child and the new entity comes into the world on its own. And that goes for finding houses or finding cars or getting work done or It's called the Manifesting Principle, and it's up on the Mirror website. It's called the Three Abrahamic Covenants and the Car Passing Trick. And it's based on what I call the Three Pillars of Love, which are Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, clear thinking, hard work, and letting go.
I get it. Let's see if we can get the feelings of our listeners. We have another caller on the line. Caller, your first name and where you're calling from, please.
Hi, my name is Dave. I'm calling from Tampa.
Hi, Dave.
Hi, how are you? Welcome to the program.
Thanks.
You have a question?
Dan Cannon is the guest, right?
Yeah.
Okay, because what I'm listening to now on the computer is there must be a time delay.
There's a time delay.
Okay. I called in.
You'll have to turn your radio off and listen just with your phone.
I can't understand anything at this point.
His line is really garbled. Let me see if my producer can.
Everything is garbled. Isn't science wonderful?
That's the wonder of trying to communicate across space and time.
If they make it any easier for us, we won't be able to talk at all.
Yeah, exactly right.
We're all going to go back to hand gestures. I'm predicting it.
Two cans and a string, something you can rely on.
That's my theory. I'm going with the hand gestures and the tin cans and the string.
Yep, I like it. Is the caller from Tampa a little clearer now?
Hello, Tampa.
Nope, I guess I'll have to try back. Anyway, what I was getting to was, I now get it. I understand that the hand is always in the same shape. And
yeah.
It is just the approach of energy to the hand.
And it's not the hand itself. Did you ever see Orthodox Jews praying and they have on their forehead a little box and on their arm they have a box and it's strapped to their arm with with a leather strap?
Yeah, it's called the phylactery.
Phylacteries, tefillin, right. This is the origin of tefillin. The strap on the hand is the model hand I'm talking about. It's not the way it's made today. It's not the way Orthodox Jews use tefillin today, phylacteries. But this, I'm saying, is the source of the modern tradition.
I get it. I understand. So that the actual wrapping of the strap is part of...
Bind it on your hand... You bind it on your hand, you bind it on your arm, you bind it on your heart, and you bind it on your mind. That's what it says in Deuteronomy. That's what it says. And that's exactly what this model does.
Very interesting.
And it generates all the letters of Hebrew and probably Arabic and Greek in a real, meaningful way, not arbitrary, that's truly universal. Just like the religious traditions have claimed, and just like science has scoffed at all these centuries.
I get it.
No fudge,
now,
no magic, no miracle, just clear thinking.
Yes. And how does this tie into the Sephirot, to the Sefer Yetzirah?
Ah, well, now, you just make a slight change in the language, and you'll know immediately. It's not the book of formation, it's the book of information. And as soon as you understand that, you know, the Sefer Yetzirah is supposed to be about the alphabet, but it never, and it's supposed to be the book of formation, and it never describes the form of the letters. Well, it does describe the form of the letters. It describes the form of the letters in the letter sequences, just like in Genesis. Not in the story, in the letters. The letters are in the letters. The letters are not in the words, and so to speak.
Very good.
Anyhow, you can find them on the website. You can find a pair of papers called The Symmetry Woven into the First Verse of Genesis and Genesis and Yetzirah. And it's a set of companion essays I wrote a number of years ago, which shows how a proper reading of Sefer Yetzirah actually makes sense and gives the geometry that I'm talking about and supplies it directly from the letters in the First Verse of Genesis, just where I found it.
Mm.
Very and I'm not saying this. Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say it's right at the top of the hour, and we're going to take another 3.5 minute break, and we'll be right back with more of Stanley Tenen and his remarkable perspective. Now that the Post gets it, maybe we can go a little bit further. And also, Stanley has a great plan for peace. A great plan for peace, and we're going to talk about it in our next hour. Don't go away.
Put hands in a line of string, please.
Friends down at NRG Resources have introduced a new engine oil technology. EBT 24/7 is the future of lubrication. This is the industry's first environmentally friendly oil additive that not only increases fuel mileage, it reduces engine, gearbox, and transaxle wear to nothing. The other brands fail anti-friction testing in less than 10 minutes under standard testing conditions. TBT 24/7 went more than 24 hours in the test and still did not fail. Get to Miles Technology today by visiting the online store at X Squared Radio and pick up TBT 24/7 Engine Oil Energizer. There is some place you should visit before the end of the week. The Horizon Project is probably the most important examination of future events in the world today. But there is a reason you should visit their website soon. I can't give you all the details here, but I can tell you that the first DVD in the six-part series is now available for pre-purchase at $5 off. This series will no doubt be airing on the History Channel or Discovery Channel, but you need the uncut version with all of the bonus material. Trust me, it may be one of the most important video productions you will ever see. Click on the Horizon Project banner at X Squared Radio today. If you have survived a disaster without food and clean water, then you need to visit NitroPack. They have been providing emergency preparedness supplies for more than 19 years. And they have everything from 72-hour kits to a full year's supply for an entire family. We wanted you to have access to the best. That is why we searched for many months to find NitroPack. Click the NitroPack banner at X Squared Radio and get prepared. The foundations of religion and science were utilized to write our first two volumes of The Ark of Millions of Years. The third volume, called Unlocking the Secret, is about to hit the presses. We want you to be aware of what is coming. You and I know that your potential is absolutely unlimited. We have crafted the final work of the trilogy so you have the tools necessary to work the law of attraction. Find out what the ancient masters knew. Learn the method necessary to affect the universe on purpose for the good of your life. Go to the online store at X Squared Radio and get your copy on order today. This is Brooks Agnew with X Squared Radio with a message for our friends in the radio broadcast world. If you have noticed that your listeners aren't around anymore, it's because they are right here with us. If you would like them back in your radio fold, then all you have to do is add X Squared Radio to your program content. The statistics don't lie. We are now the fastest growing talk radio program in North America. Don't be late, because we are about to launch another hour of X Squared Radio. Welcome back, my friends, to X Squared Radio, fellow Earth explorers all. We're into December, and it's chilly just about everywhere. I'm sure there have been calamities and weather your way, and if there haven't, we want you to be prepared for that. There is one of our affiliates, which is NitroPack. You heard the commercial earlier. Want to let you know they've been in business for over 19 years, and it took a long time to find them. We went through a lot of emergency preparedness companies, and we couldn't find anybody that was willing to work with you until we came to NitroPack. So we brought them on board, and they have really done a great job. So winter's coming. If you need to winterize your vehicle and get a little survival kit ready, So in case you slide off an icy road or run out of gas in a traffic jam on the freeway, you'll be able to survive with more than just comfort. So make sure you visit them by going to x2-radio.com and clicking on the Nitro Pack affiliate banner. We also wanted to let you know that Volume 3 of The Ark of Millions of Years is getting ready to come out in audio format. The full book, all 30 hours of it, read to you. If you're not a great reader, don't worry about it. We read it for you. And as soon as it comes out in print, those of you that have purchased Volume 1 and Volume 2, when you buy Volume 3, we will give you the audiobook with it, so you can download it and put it on your iPod and listen to the book and have it on your shelf at the same time. And also, don't forget about those Christmas gifts for those car buffs of yours. TVT 24/7 is the engine oil analyzer, engine oil energizer that prevents wear. I put it in my own Dodge Dakota, and I now have over 335,000 miles on the original engine with the original timing chain. So that's proof that the system works. And you should also know the entire Russian railroad runs with TVT 24/7 in the crankcase to prevent that catastrophic locomotive breakdown in the middle of the Siberian desert. Pick up a bottle. Just go to the online store at X2-Radio and pick it up. Phone lines are open. USA, toll-free 888-228-4494. Anywhere in Canada, 877-489-6350. Anywhere else, if you've got free long distance or a cell phone or just want to call and make a quick question, 530-776-5154 or 776-5185. And for some of you calling in on Skype, you can reach us at BBS Radio or PalTalk at BBSRadio_com, or you can always reach us at AOL Instant Messenger. My handle is Vision Officer. Just put that in your search and you'll find me. My guest is Stanley Tenen. His website is meru.org, meru.org. It is a nonprofit foundation, and as you know, all nonprofits thrive and exist on donation. So make sure that you go to that website tonight after we get off the air, or while you're listening to the broadcast tomorrow or next week. Go to meru.org and make a donation. Every little bit counts. You know, we have about 8 million people that cruise this website each week. Even a dollar from each one of those would make a big, big difference to the Meru Foundation. We want to keep good thinkers and great minds awake. In this hour, Stanley and I talked earlier before the program about his plan for peace. It sounded so plausible and so possible that we thought we'd talk about it this hour. I asked him a question because we were talking about religious awakeness and consciousness and how the roots of these languages could be understood by going back to this position of the hand and this relationship to energy. And I asked him, what happened? What happened to the state of the race? How did we decay into such a warlike race full of rage and death, all apparently inspired by God? And that's what led to this discussion. So, Stanley, let's talk about your plan for peace.
Well, that's a little more flowery than I would put it, but I appreciate the sentiment. My perspective is mathematical. I look for principles that can be applied broadly, and I know that while triangles and squares don't reconcile in two dimensions, you can make a cube octahedron of nothing but triangles and squares in 3D. Or you can look at a tetrahedron one way and it looks square, and another way it looks like a triangle. So if you go up a dimension, you can reconcile the irreconcilable, and there's an essay on that that's up on the website. One way you can make more space, we all know this, is if you want, you can have a piece of paper, and you want to draw a cube. Well, a cube doesn't fit on a piece of paper, but you can draw a big square and put a little square inside and connect up the corners, and everybody knows it's a perspective drawing of a cube. Or you can take a cube in the real world and put it inside of a bigger cube and connect up the corners, and you'd have a model or projection of a hypercube. you make, in the principle, more space when you double stuff up. Now, this is a principle that we can use to solve problems where we don't have enough space. The principal place where we don't have enough space is where there are two nations adjacent to each other, and each wants the other's territory, and they each want the other's space. So how do you make more space when there isn't enough space? Well, Mother Nature does it in a very natural and ordinary way. Everyone knows this in physics. If you have a camera, you don't touch the camera lens because it's got a coating on it. And there's a coating on the inside of the lens on the other side, too, because light has to interface between the air and the glass and the air, and it needs an intermediate area, and that's the double coating on the lens. If you look at a living body, the human body, you'll find organs are up against each other. My pancreas is hopefully someplace near my liver, but they each have their own boundaries. And between them, there's intercellular fluid and interorganic fluid and collagen and all kinds of stuff going on. And in the Bible, when Jacob and Laban make peace finally, they make a double border, a pillar and a mound, a double border. If you check the story, and I think it's in Genesis, it talks about a double border. Doubling up something makes more room and gives you more flexibility. You think you're getting less, but you actually get more. Now, in the Middle East right now, and in a number of other places too, like the DMZ between North and South Korea, in the Middle East, between Israel and Palestine, there is now already a double border. Just no one's noticed. They're just so busy being angry, they didn't notice what they did. There's the old green line, and then there's the fence the Israelis built. And between the green line and the fence is this area that no one's using. It's a road, it's a security border. It's like the double border that we did by San Diego to keep people from crossing the U.S.-Mexican border. But it's a military thing. It's a no-people zone. What if we turn the equation around and make the space between the green line and the fence an all-people zone under the condition it be kept in peace? And we flow it up across the Temple Mount, because the Temple Mount was actually rebuilt by Suleiman as a gift to the Jews and Christians. It wasn't supposed to be a bone of contention. It was supposed to be something that brought people together. And we make the area between the two borders an all-people zone and let it connect all of the separate settlements and all the separate towns of the Israelis and the Palestinians, so they don't have to be connected to each other. They can be connected through this peaceful zone. And let's use the zone. Let's have the Israelis donated immediately to the Palestinians under the condition to be kept in peace as a Hajj road for devout Muslims to use to travel between the borders between the countries as part of their journey to Mecca and Medina that they have to make at least once in their lives. And the more fervent the Muslim is, the more they're going to take responsibility for the peace of the Hajj, because it's a responsibility to keep the Hajj peaceful. And the area between the borders,
explain to us what the Hajj is and why it's
Hajj
so important.
Hajj is a pilgrimage Hajj is the pilgrimage that Muslims have to make once in their life to Mecca, if they can afford it. And so most Muslims save up their whole lives to travel from Asia Minor at great expense to get to Mecca and Medina in on the Red Sea coast in Saudi Arabia, or just inland. I'm saying,
well, how do they get there
easy.
Now?
They get down there by airplane and by boat. They get there by airplane and by boat, and they cross Saudi Arabia who knows? The modern version of caravans. I don't know. They come through Jordan. The point is, if we made the border between nations everywhere an area of interface, of ecology, of energy independence, of education of both bordering peoples for peace, then it could be a protective zone. The Israelis would get a double border of security. The Palestinians would get a strip of land they could resettle with their refugees immediately. The Israelis would get something they could donate to the Palestinians without giving up anything. The Palestinians would get contiguity of their settlements and the additional advantage of the Hajj Road and the boon to Islamic civilization that would result from the proper use of that space. Basically, what I'm talking about is using math, using quantum mechanics, using the modern worldview to overthrow the mechanistic zero-sum game and return to the realistic quantum mechanical win-win-win model. And so everything I'm proposing is a way that everyone gets what they want without having to give up anything vital. And no, so it's not that I win at your expense or you win at my expense. The more each of us wins, the better off everyone is. Those are the models that enable the planet to live and breathe. And an organic relationship among the different traditions. I call the Judaism, Christianity, and Islam the three pillars of love. Clear thinking, the people of the book. Hard work, the people of passion and compassion. And letting go, the people who submit to Allah. Those are the three stages of life. Those are the manifesting principle. That's why everything comes into the world that way. That's the model hand. The tip of the thumb is the single point, is the conceptual point. The mound, the spiral around the thumb, that's the connecting. That's the tree. And the whole of the fruit, well, Islam is the fruit. Islam is when it drops from the tree, is restarts the cycle. And the three together have an organic relationship. No one of them does the whole job. They operate in sequence and they operate simultaneously. So all of this is one model, and it has all these different aspects to it. And it all comes from realizing that responsibility for the world is in our hands. The alphabet is in our hands, and the Western traditions and the Eastern traditions are in our hands. And we have what we need already to make it all work. Have a look at the website. I'm hearing a lot of quiet again, but I'm going to assume that we're still on the air because that's what was true last time and I stopped talking, so I don't know where everyone went. But I'm going to assume that you're still hearing. One of the reasons these ideas have been lost...
I am hearing you,
but
the audience is not.
Oh, your audience is not, but you are. Wonderful. I don't know who's hearing who.
Well, I can cut in. The audience is hearing me now, but normally I can cut in silently. I'm going to try to get Dr. Brooks to stay with me. Keep going. Doing great. Love the show.
One reason why this has been lost is because it can't be passed on in literary description alone. You need to have hands-on experience with the geometry. Not with idolatrous models, but with the way that things fit together. Points, lines, circles, triangles, polyhedra. The basic building blocks of all the symmetries and all the counting systems and all the logic that is available in the entire universe. It's all one system. And when the printing press, which was a boon, is also why this was lost, because it's very hard to reproduce pictures in a simple old-fashioned printing press. So little by little, the geometric drawings were dropped out of the textbooks, and the stories without the drawings didn't make a lot of sense, and so it all became mythology, and the science was lost. And then with the help of egomaniacs like Napoleon, the people who knew about it were killed off. But in fact, the records exist, and they can be examined, and they show that if we do our work, we can put the system back together again, and there's a contribution to be made by the Jewish perspective, the Christian perspective, the Muslim perspective, and the non-believing perspective, and the believing perspective are also part of the same system, because they're two sides of the same coin, and they depend on each other. If it weren't for the skepticism of the non-believers, then the ideas of the believers wouldn't be tested and refined and would fall into silliness. The skepticism that keeps us honest, just like in science. I don't know what else to talk about without some feedback here. This is an interesting experience on the internet. I'm not sure who's hearing what. Let me therefore go on and say that if people would like to understand what I'm trying to talk about, poke around meru.org, M-E-R-U, Mary Edward Radio Underground.org, or the secure server site where we have our books and videos and stuff, which is meetingtent.com, and poke around and send email questions or order some of the DVDs and watch me make a fool of myself in video. There's also some free video. If you go to video.google.com, I guess it is, and search on Stan Tenen, You'll come up with a bunch of short videos and 2 half-hour videos, which are the ones that are worth watching. And there's an overview, a summary of a lot of old video, and there is a presentation of the gestures for the letters. So you, rather than listen to me try to describe this, you can see it for yourself.
Well, that sounds interesting.
Are we on the air?
Yeah, we're on the air.
Okay.
I don't know why I'm getting a big echo, but I can hear myself.
Yeah, I heard the echo now.
Yeah. Well, this is actually not normal for this program. We just seem to be having some really weird anomalies going on. There must be a solar flare or something going on, because it's...
Well, no, it's what I'm saying isn't supposed to reach every year.
That could be.
We do have a call.
Yeah, it's like Schrodinger's cat. We live in a superposition, and not every part of reality is seen by everyone else. I was once sitting in an apartment of a friend in Berkeley, in Berkeley Hills, and we were sitting opposite each other at a kitchen table, and there was a window at one end of the table. And so we both had a view of the sky and out the window. But at one point, my friend mentioned that the weather was really getting rotten, and because he could see out in the bay that there was a storm coming in. Whereas I was looking out the other side of the window, the same window, and I was looking up towards the clear sky over the Berkeley Hills. Same window, but 2 views of reality.
How about that? Well, let's get the view of one of our listeners. Caller, your first name and where you're calling from, please.
Hi, Brooks. It's Haya. I just got cut off from the last time. Hello?
Hello?
Yeah, we're still here. We've had some real fun with our telephones tonight, so go ahead.
Yes, I know. The problem is when you were putting the website out for Stanley Tennant, I didn't catch it, and I got Nehru.org, but it won't come up on the Internet.
Oh, it's M-E-R-U, as in Michael Edward. Yeah, that's a little hard for it to come out on the air between M and N. And then Nehru is a little bit more popular of a word than Nehru, but that's how you get to his website. So make sure you get there, read his information, and he's got some excellent, excellent links on there. There are hours of reading, excellent stuff, and very good graphic work that's been done.
Yes, I found it very interesting. I was going to clarify. He was talking about if you take an apple, an ordinary apple, scoop out the middle and put your finger in, that's actually what makes the shape of the hand he's talking about?
No.
Look at the website. You'll see it. I mean, it's very hard to describe.
Okay.
It's very hard to describe.
When you peel the apple, the skin comes off in kind of a spiral, and that's what he's talking about.
If you do it properly... There's a bunch of very nasty people on the Internet who misrepresented how that's done. But if you look at our website, you'll see accurate pictures of what it's all about. It's hard to describe, but it's based on an asymmetrical spiral, the Egyptian spiral, the one under the Eye of Horus, projected onto a sphere, and it fits in a hand, and it takes the shape of a dimpled sphere, which is a mathematical model of an apple. And you literally lift the model hand off the apple. But you have to see the picture. The reason this has been lost is because all the description in the world just confuses people. You got to look at the pictures.
Exactly.
Isn't that great when
you
get it?
Mean,
it's like a light going off.
And then all the letters are just different shadows, different ways of looking at that one same model of the unity of God's names. That's it.
Okay.
He's got some animations. He's got some animations on his website that show the wrapping and unwrapping of this energy and different perspectives of it. And from those perspectives, you get every single letter.
Yep.
Oh, my gosh. I have the book. I must have the book. I'm looking at it right here, and I'm seeing the hands. Okay. Yes, thank you very much.
Yeah, there's plenty of free information on Nehru.org, but if people really want to understand it, I know it's hard. You got to watch my smiling face for like 10, 12 hours, but there's DVDs of the lectures I gave during the 1990s, at Arthur Young's Institute for the Study of Consciousness, and on the Thinking Aloud series with Jeffrey Mishlove, and at the 3220 Gallery with Henry Dakin's Place, and the Fundamental Physics Group people, and all of that. It's all archived. It's all documented. But you don't need to buy stuff. You can look at the free stuff, and then if you really want it, then you order what you want, and then you make the models for yourself. That's when you really learn. You
well,
got to see the pictures,
what
though.
You
got
to
see the pictures.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. And don't be confused by the misrepresentations that are all over the internet. We won a lawsuit against a Satanist, and it didn't do us any good. So it only made them angrier.
Oh, really?
Yeah, you'll find...
Well,
if you Google my name, you'll find I'm the worst person that ever existed.
Well, then you're probably the one that's got the most information.
Well, I'm sorry they decided to rob my bank, but after all, we did have good currency in stock. They had good choice in what they stole, but I wish they hadn't done it. Anyhow, the real material is much more sensible and easier to understand than the rip-off stuff. So go for the gold.
Okay, thank you very, very much.
Thank you, Haya.
I do understand now. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Stanley, I was going to ask a question about this eschatological pathway that it seems our governments and our leaders, I'm really amazed at the language that they use, President Bush and even leaders of other nations. It seems like I guess the question I want to ask is, does your plan for peace fall into or fulfill any of these prophecies that seem to be out there in various texts?
What I'm proposing goes against all the prophecies I've ever heard.
I like it automatically.
That there's no special time, there's no millennium coming, everybody grows up, this is repeated perennial tradition, the alphabet's been rediscovered many times, there was a golden age in Spain, there was a golden age in Babylonia, there was a golden age even before Egypt, that history is both linear and cyclical, we progress, but we also continue to recycle the same ideas. And life is what each of us makes it. The basic model that I'm finding from the Abrahamic traditions is we make our own life. We have to be responsible. And it doesn't seem that way initially, because things cause and effect don't always happen immediately. But the golden rule is not an admonition. It's like the law of gravity. What goes around really does come around. It just may take a while. And that's both the good and the bad. You know, people
there's definitely some mathematical proof for that too, because there is, you know, the principle of resonance, and if you make a choice and you exercise some energy toward that choice and nothing happens,
it's more like Newton. It's more like impulse and momentum, action and reaction.
Yeah.
It's the idea is that when you take an action in the world, you send ripples of causation into the world. And they resound back, ultimately. And so that's the true meaning of an eye for an eye. It wasn't they plucked out an eye for another eye. An eye for an eye is the golden rule. It means that what goes around comes around. A spectrum, the eye sees a spectrum of things, not just a field of view, a spectrum. A spectrum of causes leads to a spectrum of consequences. That's common sense. That's what these teachings are really about.
Well, you have to realize two things, that when you make the cause and it has its effect and the result comes back around to you, you've got to be aware of what's coming towards you so that you can do one of two things. You can either ignore it and say, oh, gee, well, that didn't work, or you can hit it again as it comes around and you constructively interfere with
that. Right. You can
do
Aikido with your own karma. You can take back the energy, reorient yourself, and redirect it better than you did the first time. Yeah, you can.
Yeah. And Fibonacci
says... You can redirect your own karma.
Fibonacci says that the eighth iteration will result in a golden mean.
Oh, the Fibonacci stuff is complete hokum. That's the garbage stuff. These are the people who ripped off my work and are making a cult out of Fibonacci. Fibonacci was a brilliant mathematician in his age, but it's old hat, and it's the basis of cult after cult. The Fibonacci numbers, the golden spiral, all of that is narcissistic. It always reproduces in its own self-image. It's the exact opposite of spiritual growth. the Nautilus shell does not take the form of a golden spiral. Mathematically, that's not correct. That's what the artists think. That's what people who repeat the same misinformation think. But it's all a bugaboo, and there are mathematicians that, you know, have been railing about this for decades, but who reads mathematics? But the public thinks that there's something magical there. There isn't. The golden proportion is a trace of death, not a trace of life. It's the embryonic spiral, the one under the eye of Horus, that's the trace of life. Life
yes.
is asymmetrical, not just because we have a left and a right arm. That's trivial symmetry. It's because we grow from a tiny fertilized egg into a whole human being. It's the asymmetry over time that typifies life, and that's the spiral under the eye of Horus, the most asymmetrical spiral possible.
And the fact that it doesn't do it on its own, that is to say, we don't develop intelligence and wisdom and everything on our own. We have to be consciously involved in that. We are responsible for it, and
that's
therefore
right.
responsible
right.
for our life condition.
That's right. That's right. Which means that things don't repeat constantly in the same image, that they're non-narcissistic. We have to learn and grow and take responsibility. That's, again, the same principle that I'm saying. Sometimes good and bad can be very similar and very close together, and it's hard to tell them apart. And people think that it's trivial which kind of spiral is involved in making these models. But in fact, it's a very big difference. One goes into orbit, and the other one crashes and burns, to put it that way. And so it does make a difference, not for everyone all the time. The basic model that makes the letters is the idea of a hand, because a hand makes gestures that carry meaning naturally. And the mathematics is simply the model we make to make understanding more convenient. So ultimately, the math isn't important at all. It's just our record-keeping scheme. But the principle of our pointing to what we mean, to what we care about, and others seeing where we're pointing and learning from it, that's fundamental to any living creature. That's truly universal. And that's what the sacred alphabets and the universal language of the Bible is talking about. The Tower of Babel was not about the story, it's not the story of the loss of spoken language. It's the story of the loss of knowledge that all language derives from gesture. That's the story of the Tower of Babel.
And was that a
beautiful?
Single event? Was that a single event, or was that just a migration where that
No,
that
the stories in the Bible are, according to rabbinic tradition, the stories in the Bible cannot be taken literally alone. You are supposed to accept them in their simple meaning because that makes the simplest sense for passing them on and for teaching young people. But basically, it's not a literal story. The mythology was thought to be literal, but the stories are basically the carrier, the clear text for the Torah traditions, for the Bible traditions. Most people
don't
know that.
That's kind of what I get from it, too, that Nimrod really wasn't the cause, and the Tower of Babel.
No, they just picked those stories
from
because people were familiar with them. There's quotations on the Mirror website about how anyone who thinks that the stories in the Bible are really the Bible has no place in the world to come. That's like misjudging the garment a person is wearing for the character of the person that's wearing the garment. That the real light in the Bible is not the stories, but the relationships and the principles that are carried in the letter text, not just in the stories. They enhance
the
support each other, but they're
not
the same.
Is the observation that the manuscripts that it took to create the library, the biblio, what we call the library, what we call the Bible today, which is much, much more than the original five books, is it safe to say that over time, that's been truncated by, you know, fear or war or loss or one thing or another?
Well, we know that the Inquisition destroyed parts of the Talmud that have not been recovered. So the oral Torah that, you know, has in part been lost. Some Muslim traditions claim that it was Ishmael and not Isaac that was the subject of the object of the sacrifice. So they claim the Jews changed the story. But in fact, the only thing we're sure it has its own integrity intact are the five books. And the reason is because of the so-called Bible codes. There are these check patterns. The text itself is a woven structure. It is a harmonic structure. And thereby you can see a mistake in the weave. It sticks out. If it's musical, you can hear a missed note. So if you know the principle of the coherence of a structure, you can tell if something has gone awry and you can repair it. You asked earlier on in the first hour about the Ten Commandments. Part of the purpose of the Ten Commandments is to maintain the principles that maintain the integrity of the text. So we know the five books are pretty much as they have been over all the centuries. Even the scholars don't think there have been more than a couple of hundred mistakes that have crept in. The rabbis claim that maybe no more than six letters have been miscopied over the centuries. The total number of letters in the entire five books is about 304,805 letters. So of that, only five are in question. Pretty good. And if you think of a woven structure, you can wear a sweater and not notice that one or two threads have been pulled for quite a while before you have to give it up to the moth. So
right,
in fact,
right.
The overall pattern, a person can play a symphony and get one note wrong, and you're not going to, all right, that's a terrible note, but you go right on listening to the symphony.
Right.
So the integrity of the five books should be unquestioned. But the Psalms aren't even the same in the Hebrew and Christian tradition. Jewish tradition and Christian tradition don't count the Psalms the same. Some are longer, some are shorter, and one or the other. They're not numbered the same. There are significant differences. In some of the books that the Christian Bible includes, the Hebrew Bible doesn't, and vice versa, I think. I'm not sure what the Christians include.
Well,
but,
someone asked me earlier today, after you and I spoke, if the core pieces of truth had been removed, like whole chunks of Beethoven's Fifth pulled out, or say the strings of a guitar removed, when someone went to make music with a guitar, it just wouldn't work. I mean, no one would follow.
But that's not true.
Like that.
But that's not true of a number like pi, where if somebody erases some of the digits and you know the principle, you can fill them in. If the Torah letter patterns are what I think they are, a natural pattern in nature, something that's real, and you know the principle, then even if parts have been destroyed or damaged, God forbid, you could repair them inerrantly if you knew the basic principles. It's not like an arbitrary thing. It's a universal invariant. Totally different than an arbitrary structure.
I understand, but when you have a conqueror, like you mentioned earlier, Napoleon coming in and, chasing down the rabbit.
Well, he killed people, but he killed people, but the documents exist. And now, since science has rediscovered the principles, we can read the documents. I wouldn't know what the rabbi writing 200 years ago was talking about if I hadn't read Roger Penrose recently. But having read Penrose, who discovered it through physics, now I can make sense of what the rabbi was saying in somewhat archaic language. In other words, we learn over time. We can go back, and now we can get the DNA of some of the dinosaurs we couldn't get previously. We have more tools.
Yeah, but I guess the point that I was trying to make is these conquerors come in and ostensibly control whole nations, whole generations of people.
Let me ask you a question.
By eliminating truth.
Let me ask you a question.
Okay.
If something is alive, if you have a mushroom and you've got tarmac, which one wins? The mushroom breaks the tarmac. The reason that Judaism, Christianity, and Islam have gone on is because they are truly living traditions, which means that things that oppose life are ultimately ground down and crushed. The reason why Judaism, people wonder, how can the Jews keep surviving? It's because the Torah system is a living system. The very similar system that the Karaites had, which were Jews and intermarried with Jews up until maybe 1,000 or so years ago, was very similar. But the Karaites didn't maintain the oral Torah. They didn't maintain the Talmud. They only carried the Bible. They didn't have the whole system. And so it stopped being a living system. It couldn't repair itself anymore. The Jewish tradition at the moment is still alive. It, like a salamander, can regrow a leg.
Well, I look at the Christian tradition. I mean, Christianity, per se, really didn't get its legs until the Gutenberg Press started proliferating certain parts of these writings.
That's right. Christianity.
So,
that's right.
Really didn't come from
life.
It was controlled by the state, and it was a state religion, and it was it was an incorporation of many pagan beliefs into what you know became a faith in a savior. But really, I mean, the 17th century Christianity really started to get its legs, but that's hardly ancient history.
Actually, the best history of Christianity I've ever read is Constantine's Sword, which is just a brilliant history of the last 2,000 years. It was written by a former Catholic priest who's still Catholic. He's not a priest anymore. Cahill, I think his name is. He writes for the Boston Globe. Brilliant history. It goes through all of what could have been, what might have been, the missed opportunities, the unnecessary antagonism. But if you really read between the lines, the problem is not the religions. The problem is the empires who tried to take control of the religions. And
absolutely. Same thing that we're noticing today. We're seeing Islam hijacked by
these loonies.
Zealots. Yeah.
They won't be around much longer. The Muslims are going to wise up and take them down. They've peaked out. You know, people didn't realize in the Second World War it was already over by the Battle of Midway. A lot of people died and suffered after that, but the war was determined at Midway. You know, if you check the history, the same is true of the Intifadas, and the same is true of the Muslim fanatics. It's over. They've already lost. They just hasn't. It's terrible. It's really terrible. A lot of people are going to still die. I'm not saying the fighting is over. I'm not saying there isn't bad to come. But I'm saying, in principle, in the sweep of history, we've already turned the corner. They've already lost their own people.
So are we going to walk away?
It's not what we're doing. They've lost their own people.
Are we going to be able to walk away from this eschatological Gog and Magog, this Armageddon?
Absolutely. Let me show you the power of this idea to clarify this kind of a problem. Gog and Magog, you couldn't pick a better example. Complete nonsense, but it's nonsense that has sense behind it. If you look at the meaning of the Hebrew letters and you analyze what Gog and Magog mean, it becomes obvious what's being discussed. And it's a principle that goes on all the time. It's not about Armageddon. It's something that we live with all the time.
Uh-huh.
The word Gog is spelled Gimel Vav Gimel, and it means action and action, which we would call reaction.
Uh-huh.
And the word Magog, the mem prefix means what comes from, source of, means counter-reaction. Gog is the reactive attitude, and Magog is the counter-reactive attitude. And the cure for both of them is proaction, just going straight ahead and doing the right thing. And that's what I'm proposing. Use the golden rule, cuts right through the middle. Neither Gog nor Magog. We see that all the time. We'll see that somebody does something and they meet a public need and they get a following, and then there's a reaction, a counter-reaction, and then they fight with each other. But in fact, neither side has a patent on the truth. It's someplace in between. And the fighting is the essence for is fighting for its own self. They're just fighting over fighting. It's reaction and counter reaction. There's no action in it anywhere. It's only just noise.
Well, and it's noise because of chaos. And chaos comes from unconsciousness and fear, and that's
and lack of direction.
See.
Lack of direction. Chaos comes, you know, look, there's a wonderful metaphor that I've been examining recently. There's been a lot of work done recently on the way that fish and birds and insects swarm and school and flock. And what happens is the exact opposite of what happens when a rocket takes off and loses control. A rocket launches under control, it's perfectly straight, it starts going up. And then something, the software goes amok or the hardware goes amok and starts to spiral out of control in these toroidal loops. And then it crashes into chaos on the ground. Flocking and swarming is the opposite. It starts with a chaotic distribution of creatures just milling around. And then they start to form a circle and a loop and they start to orbit each other. And then after they've formed the toroidal loop, then they move off in a single line as a school in one direction. That the process of going from chaos to torus to line, or from line to torus to chaos, is universal. But that's also another way to describe exactly the same geometry of the hand model that makes the Hebrew, Greek, and Arabic letters. It's the same organizing principle. You can watch it in fish that are schooling, or birds that are flocking, or insects that are swarming.
Wow.
It can be observed in nature without modern physics, without modern biology, without our people living in the Middle East, in the ancient world, using their ordinary senses.
That is outstanding. Absolutely outstanding.
Same model. At every level, it's the same model. That's why the insistence on the oneness of God. There's one model, one unified theory that decants into everything. The one to the many. Particle to wave. Can I leave with a really important idea?
Yes, go ahead.
I wrote a piece on immortality, which is called On Immortality. I think it's up on the website. And it's an analogy. It's not a proof. I don't know what happens. I'm not a prophet. This is just a mathematical model. But it's a really neat, intriguing one.
Okay.
Everybody's cell phone, everybody's computer has in it something called a tunnel diode. The tunnel diode operates on a principle that if you have an electron traveling through a wire and it comes on an insulator, it can't get through. It stops. But its wave function can tunnel through the insulator and reform the electron on the other side. It's called quantum mechanical tunneling, and I'm probably oversimplifying it. The point is that the particle cannot get through the physical barrier, but the wave can. Our particle nature as living beings, as humans, is our ego, and our wave nature is our loving kindness. Our egos, our ability to make choices, to look for our self-interest, that's what dies when our body dies. But our loving kindness goes on forever. And that's why every great tradition advocates loving kindness. So that the principle of loving kindness is supported, the tradition of loving kindness that's advocated by all our great faiths is actually supported by the findings of the most cutting edge quantum mechanics.
And that is the energy of the survival of the race. To be sure,
there's always under an infinite God in an expanding universe, there is always room for new creativity, new imagination, new solutions. There is always room for win-win-win solutions. We are in quantum mechanical superposition. It is not me or you. It's plenty of room for both of us together. That's the modern model. Mechanics, mechanical, the Newtonian paradigm says that the zero-sum game is best, but the quantum mechanical paradigm says the golden rule is best. It really works when you actually run the game theory. If you use quantum mechanical principles, the golden rule works better than the selfish tit-for-tat rule. Really.
Sure.
Not just advocacy.
Then you don't end up with zero as the answer.
Hmm?
My guest tonight has been Stan Kenen. His website is Meru, that's M-E-R-U, like Michael Edward Ramon Alpha.org. Please go and visit his website. Remember, Meru Foundation is a foundation. It's a nonprofit, operates off of your donations. So, this Christmas is a good time to extend your heart. Go to that website, make a small donation. There are many, many, many of you out there, so a little bit goes a long, long way. Stanley, I appreciate so much.
Better than a donation. Get one of the videos and watch me make a fool of myself, and you'll learn a lot more.
there you go.
And seriously, we want people to have the information. And if you can't afford to buy something, we'll try to get it to you for whatever you think you can afford. I mean, basically, our job is to get these ideas out there. Even if I'm right, if I'm the only one who knows this stuff, it's still totally vain. The only way that something becomes real is when it reaches other people's hearts. So that's
correct.
What this is all about.
Correct.
Thank you
so much for coming on the program.
Thank you for having me. It's been a great pleasure. I'm sorry that the technology went amok, but
that's part of
the program, too.
We'll stay in contact, and this third hour will be up in the podcasting free listening area. So those of you that are listening that know Stanley can send your friends here and listen to this interview. We appreciate you being on the program. Good night, sir.
Good night. Thank you very much. Be well.
You're welcome. And merry holidays.
Happy Hanukkah, Merry Christmas, Happy Tet, Happy Ramadan, Happy Kwanzaa. You know, whatever floats your boat, enjoy it. Have a great holiday season.
All right, thank you. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
All right, my friends, Earth Explorers all, we appreciate you being here. Next week, we've got a program for you. We've got the inventor of a time machine coming on the program. You don't want to miss it. We'll be back next week with more X Squared Radio. It has been a great pleasure to have you here with us this evening. Tell a friend about us, because every Sunday evening at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, we bring you the best 3 hours of exploration into the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. If you're not getting all 3 hours, send us the call letters of your local station, and we'll do the rest. Remember, Earth Explorers, that you are Source. Everything we do will eventually affect the universe, so try to do it on purpose. Reach out for the good in people and help it to grow a little every day. And before long, you will have saved the planet. This is X Squared Radio saying, peace, Earth Explorers.